Hi, this is Galia Pakman, and you're listening to another episode of the McGill International Review podcast. In this edition, I'm joined by Gabe Rotman from the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. that works to protect American journalists. We discuss the challenges of reporting on immigration issues, the dangers that journalists face when covering protests, threats to the media during Trump's second term, and more. In doing so, we also cover a number of legal concepts and court cases, both historical and contemporary. We hope you enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of MIR's podcast. I'm joined today by Gabe Rotman, Vice President of Policy at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. Also, proud McGill grad.
Just to get us started here, why don't you introduce the Reporters Committee to listeners? So who are you? What do you do?
So the Reporters Committee is it's a national nonprofit. We're based in Washington, D.C. We're the leading provider of free legal services for journalists in the United States. And we've been around for about 50 years. We were founded back in the early 1970s when the Nixon administration was seeking to force journalists to identify confidential sources in court. And a number of prominent journalists and media lawyers realized that there was a real need for a nonprofit that could represent broadly the interests of the news media and advocate for press freedom, you know, on behalf of sort of the whole industry. And so that's what we do. And, you know, I'm a practicing attorney, and most of my colleagues are actually courtroom lawyers. They're litigators. They're in court around the country, directly representing journalists. I handle more of our engagement with Congress and the regulatory agencies. And I also work very closely with the legal team, especially on issues that are related to national security, or kind of my major is, I call it leak law, but it's this whole body of law and regulation that governs when and how government officials can seek to force journalists to identify confidential sources, which in the U.S. is a very, very sensitive topic because, one, we have the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, which directly protects freedom of the press. And also there's long been a debate in the United States over the appropriate level, how to calibrate secrecy and transparency. You know, and the founders of the U.S., the folks who wrote the Constitution, were well aware that secrecy can breed deprivations of liberty. And so when it comes to the government's ability to tamp down on confidential sources coming forward with information in the public interest to journalists, you know, there's a concern that could lead to a broader clampdown on civil liberties.
Just to kind of set the scene for listeners, I think that when we, the general public, think of threats to journalists and the media, like especially if we're following international news, maybe news in Latin America, we think of an authoritarian regime or a dictator who's going around physically intimidating journalists, you know, things like death threats or assassinations, that sort of very blatant, violent crackdown. I mean, in the case of the U.S., we have had more recently, like the indictment against Don Lemon, like a prominent media personality who's covering immigration issues. But I still think that the general impression is that the threats to journalists are more subtle or more insidious somehow. Mm-hmm. Can you just clarify, you know, is that an accurate view? And when you talk about threats to press freedom in the United States, what specific issues or behavior are you really referring to?
So it's a great question. And I think that the way that you've framed it is correct. The U.S. has, both in law, but also in political culture, a real commitment to, you know, freedom for the thought that we hate, which is a phrase that Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes used right after the US had entered World War I in a case that represented kind of the birth of the modern understanding of the First Amendment. In other words, the US has very, very, very strong speech protections, which also bleed over into protections for the press, right? And so, the courts have long said that, we have a free press, not necessarily a fair press, for instance. And the bottom line is there's a balance that has been struck that has long been agreed to in the US that when you're talking about the government's interference in press independence, the juice just isn't worth the squeeze. Oftentimes, if you're talking about, for instance, defamation law or something like that, the calls to regulate press independence or intrude on press independence can sound beneficent. But the courts, and again, our political culture have decided that the balance that we've struck is that we protect press independence. And so, 100% that journalists are not being killed for their reporting. It certainly does happen, but it's much rarer than in other parts of the world. And one of the more dangerous places for journalists physically, right, is covering protest activity. And we see things like detentions, arrests, or uses of force, both by law enforcement and by protesters. But I think the fights that you do see here tend to be cases where there have been longstanding norms that have protected press independence, but not necessarily laws. And so what you end up doing is fighting over those unsettled questions. Famously, the Pentagon Papers case was really the first time that the federal government in the US had tried to impose what the lawyers call a prior restraint, basically restraining publication in advance through a court order. And that never happened before. And so the courts were grappling with, a completely unsettled question of law. And the Supreme Court pretty decisively said that prior restraints are improper, even in national security cases, even in cases where the government is claiming that that the publication of its secrets could lead to national security harm. The court said still improper, except in the most extreme circumstances. And people usually see that case as decisive victory for press freedom and freedom of speech in the U.S. But the law is much more unsettled, and the fact that there was this maybe uneasy détente between press and the government before the Pentagon Papers case, where people kind of assumed the existence of these freedoms, people were concerned that even after that case, that the rights that journalists and news organizations had expected to protect them maybe weren't quite as secure as one thought. And so there's a good modern example of this where a Washington Post reporter, Hannah Nathanson, who had called herself the federal government whisperer because she was covering the second Trump administration's efforts to reorganize the federal government, and she had posted her Signal information on a chat featuring government employees, and she'd been fielding tips from potentially more than 1,000 confidential sources. And for the first time ever, the US government, the Department of Justice, executed a search warrant seizing all of her electronic devices at her home in connection with a separate investigation of a government contractor who is under indictment for leaking government secrets. There is a federal law that's supposed to prohibit newsroom searches and searches of journalists, except in cases where the journalist is really suspected of having committed a crime outside of journalism. But it does. It's difficult to see how the government complied with that law in its application for the search warrant for Nathanson's home. But the fact that we're now in court, and the judge who is presiding over it, the same judge that issued the warrant, saying we're kind of on untrod ground, undiscovered country. It's those kinds of disputes that you tend to see become major press freedom controversies in the U.S. The other thing that you tend to see too is a lot of stuff at the grassroots level, a lot of stuff at the state and local level. And, you'll have a local journalist, maybe one or two people in a newsroom facing financial pressures because of the collapse of local news. And they're doing accountability reporting regarding a local public official. And that local public official will try and do something, get them arrested, have them investigated, what have you, or even just sue them for defamation. And it's those types of fights too that happen with some frequency. And it's why it's really crucial to have kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of weedy protections in state and local law for press freedom. So it is a very long answer to a very short question, which is you're 100% correct that you don't see the same kinds of, actual physical violence directed at journalists, but you have this constant give and take where advocates for press freedom are trying to retain strong protections in law, both in the Constitution and in federal and state law. And then we have these debates going, on and on about what is the appropriate balance between, for instance, government secrecy and transparency.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up local newsrooms because one of my big questions is obviously the like vulnerabilities or pressures facing small scale independent media probably aren't the same as these larger, corporations or even, public and private media. Notably, of course, Trump pretty early in his term announced that public broadcasters like NPR and PBS would no longer receive federal funding. Can you elaborate a bit more on like the distinct problems facing these different scales or sectors of the media, for lack of a better word?
Sure. So certainly when you're talking about, major media organizations with the resources and footprint in the public imagination to fight these fights, right, that they're in a better position than a small local, outlet. But I think what's also key is that the small local outlet, it's not just news organizations. Freedoms of the press, are crucial, but they're also, and it's kind of interesting, just as a matter of constitutional law, but the Supreme Court tends not to distinguish between freedom of speech and freedom of the press. They're protected separately in the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom to peaceably assemble, freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances, and then religious liberty. But so it mentions them separately, but the court, when it's looking at these questions, tends to consider them together. And a really good example of that, which goes to your question about the difference in resources, is there's a case that's famous in the US called New York Times v. Sullivan that arose out of the civil rights era. And what it involved was an advertisement in the New York Times that was critical of the arrest of Martin Luther King. And it contained kind of minor factual inaccuracies. And at the time, defamation law was a state issue. And so you had officials in the South who were using defamation law to try and intimidate news organizations and others into not covering civil rights issues. And so that advertisement in the New York Times, so again, not a news story, right? An actual advertisement that somebody went and paid for was the basis for multi-hundreds of thousands of dollars lawsuit by Southern officials. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that in cases where public officials are suing for defamation, so government officials, that you need to prove in court. It's the one of the more unfortunate phrases in U.S. constitutional law, something called actual malice, which is really not very descriptive because it has nothing to do with being malicious. But basically, what it means is if a public official is suing for defamation, the public official needs to prove that the person who made the allegedly defamatory statement acted with actual knowledge that it was false or really harbored subjective doubts about its truth, which is a crucial protection for both the press and kind of for the little person, right? If we're talking about that, who's just speaking out on matters of public concern. And one of the reasons for that, and this is all bringing it back to your question, also about these asymmetries and resources. The one of the reasons why that's so important is that the public official who's doing the suing, right, tends to have pretty strong legal protections themselves. So, for instance, if you're a legislator in the US, typically you'll have almost absolute legislative immunity. So, if you get up on the floor of the state legislature or the floor of Congress and you say that Gabe Rotman committed a crime, Gabe Rotman is a liar, what have you, I have no recourse. There's nothing I can do. Whereas if I say the same thing about them, they can sue me. So that's why the court put this actual malice requirement into the law, effectively saying, look, defamation was a state issue. It's also a part of something that's called common law, which is judge-made law that we inherited, as did other countries with British legal systems. But neither of those can trump the US Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. And so the court said that the First Amendment necessarily needs to put brakes on the ability of public officials to sue for defamation, precisely to address the issue that you just raised, right? Which is that there are these power imbalances. You've got public officials who have these broad immunities. And what's really important in order to preserve robust public discourse is to ensure that there are strong legal protections for individuals who may have fewer resources speaking about issues of public concern.
You mentioned that in litigation or in the court of law, there's not a very strong distinction between freedom of expression and freedom of the press. How does this play out, for instance, in regards to citizen journalism? I've been thinking a lot about this in regard to like recent immigration crackdown. So much of what we know about ICE, their use of force and violence has become widely available to the public thanks to citizens who were just in the right place at the right time, took a video and shared that footage often through social media. To what extent can that coverage, fall under the category of journalistic activity or free press? Do they have the same protections? How would that play out in court?
It's a really great question. So first of all, what's key is that even though the court doesn't generally distinguish between freedom of the press and freedom of speech, what it does do is it will take a functional approach to who qualifies as a journalist. And one of the reasons for that is the origin of the First Amendment in the US. It dealt with kind of two major things. One was something called seditious libel, which is criticizing the government. And then the other is licensing. So it used to be the fact that if you were a printer, you need to get a license in order to print. And both of those are supposed to be anathema under the US constitutional system. And so when it comes to licensing, courts are reticent to say you're a journalist and you're not a journalist because that could look like government licensing. Courts are a government body. So what that means is that if you're acting journalistically, you'll generally receive the First Amendment protections when they apply. And the courts won't really make a distinction between, let's say somebody who is on the street corner, with a cell phone, sees something happening, starts to record, but realizes, whoa, this is really newsworthy. And I want to get my recording out to the public. You can legally turn into a journalist, in that moment. And so the First Amendment will protect you the same as it would protect somebody from a major national newspaper. Now, all of that said, there is discussion about whether the press clause, so we call them clauses, right? There's the press clause, speech clause, petition clause, assembly clause, and the religion clauses. There's a discussion right now among media lawyers and others about whether the courts should treat the press clause and the speech clause differently, depending on what the situation is. And there may be arguments for that in certain cases. The reason why I'm just pointing this out is because it's a true statement that the courts generally treat speech rights and press rights the same, but there's some debate as to whether they should in all cases. And so, for instance, I tend to think of them as press clause cases, but there's a whole string of cases starting actually kind of in the 20s and 30s and going all the way up to 70s, 80s, where states would impose taxes that disproportionately burdened news organizations. And then sometimes they would impose taxes. So for instance, familiar with Huey Long in Louisiana, a famous populist, he supported a law that treated newspapers that were his allies differently from newspapers that were his enemies. And the court said, you can't do that. And that's a case where if you impose taxes that disproportionately burden news organizations, right, you can't discriminate against news organizations in the field of taxation. So you could kind of think about those as press cases. Anyways, way more detail than you need, but it's an interesting ongoing debate.
Since we're on the topic of immigration, kind of tangentially, do reporters face particular legal challenges when covering immigration issues? Or like on the flip side, do they benefit from any particular legal protections?
So it's also a terrific question. There are more challenges, I would say, than there are, advantages when it comes to immigration. And I would say that one, I mentioned that the most dangerous place for journalists to do their job is protest activity. And obviously, there's been a huge amount of protest activity around immigration enforcement during the second Trump administration. And we've certainly seen incidents involving federal officers who are with component agencies of the Department of Homeland Security and their interactions with journalists that are troubling. And so we've actually asked for a meeting with the Department of Homeland Security to urge them to comprehensively train all of their officers on how to interact with journalists in the field. We haven't heard back, which is unfortunate. And I think we would really very much like to engage because there are practical, actionable, common sense things that all law enforcement agencies can do to avoid the situation where a journalist is detained, arrested, or injured while covering a protest, including things like a policy of arrest avoidance, where if a journalist is detained during a protest, even if the detention is okay, right? Even if it's very difficult to tell that it's a journalist, it's dark, lots of people around. As soon as the journalist says, I'm press," and establishes that they are in fact a journalist, that the officers are trained to let them go and let them continue to do their job. And one of the reasons why that's really important is because when I talk about protests being dangerous, specifically one of the things that becomes even more dangerous is when officers issue a dispersal order, kind of clear the street, everybody go. When that happens, journalists tend to get swept up in those types of activities. So in that sense, covering immigration can be physically and legally dangerous for journalists, for many of the same reasons that protests are particularly fraught contexts. The other issue that comes up in immigration is access to information. And because immigration courts are a bit different than your normal federal courts, there are unique access issues. And if you really want the details on that, there is a very in the weeds issue that we at the Reporters Committee have been working on, which is there is a federal rule that says, so for most courts, there's a system called PACER, which is the electronic, docketing system for the courts. So you can go on PACER and look up a lawsuit in federal court and then download the complaint or other filings in the case. And you can do it from the comfort of your own home. In immigration cases, there's a rule that certain filings are not placed in a manner that's publicly available. So you literally have to go to the courthouse and access those filings at a public terminal at the courthouse. So it adds a huge practical burden in reporting on immigration cases. And one of the reasons why that's of real import, given the surge in immigration enforcement activity over the last year, is the administration is detaining many more individuals that are arrested in immigration proceedings. Typically, if you don't have a criminal record and you're not seen as a threat to the community, you're effectively given bail. And because of those additional detentions, you have a surge in individuals who are detained challenging their detention under something called a writ of habeas corpus, which is an ancient writ that goes all the way back to Britain. It basically means that you can go to a judge. And the judge can force the person who's detained the individual to justify the detention. So all of those habeas cases and all of those detentions, it becomes much more difficult to report on them.
About access to information, I looked through your litigation archive before the interview. I see a ton of cases that are about, like, say, a county jail or like a school board who isn't providing journalists with the documents that they need for investigation. Sort of changing the subject to tech, how do you see changes in technology impacting information access for journalists and like the sorts of cases you're seeing? Like, is online censorship, for instance, becoming a bigger issue, or is there anything else kind of related to that you could speak on?
So certainly technological advancement actually provides I think significant opportunities for improvements to public access. Getting the government to adopt new technologies can be challenging, and also getting them to deploy them in a way that is access promoting can also be challenging. One of the things that has bedeviled the American legal system, going back to the advent of the telegraph or the telephone or modern or the birth of telecommunications, is how different communications technologies are treated under the First Amendment. There every time there's a new technology, motion pictures, radio, television, what have you, there's always a fight over do they receive the same First Amendment protections as, let's say, newspapers, right? Where everybody agrees that when the First Amendment was written, newspapers were all over the place, although they were deeply partisan. You didn't have the same kind of media landscape that you have now, but people agreed that newspapers were protected. And so with the birth of broadcast, right? So radio and television, where you get it literally over the air, right? Bunny or broadcasting, the courts have determined that you can treat that slightly differently than other media. And that's led now to a situation, and specifically what you can do is engage in something called content-based regulation. In other words, the government can regulate what it sees as perceived bias, for instance, in news. It's exceedingly rare for the government to be able to do that in the context of newspapers or other forms of media. It's the reason why you'll see profanity, on cable, but not as much on network television that you get on a local broadcast television station or radio station. So that's led to a situation now where the chair of the Federal Communications Commission, our telecommunications regulator, has been citing a lot of those rules and policies, in connection with news reporting or other public information broadcasting, like interviews with public officials on late night talk shows, has been citing those rules and policies in a way that's very troubling, suggesting that the FCC can take action against those licensees because of news reporting that the FCC sees as slanted. So that's one issue that we're facing because of, advances in technology. And then there's the additional debate over the internet, where the Supreme Court back in the late 1990s said that the internet should be treated the same as all other media, except broadcast, of course, but the same as all other media. And also said, look, we don't treat speech differently because of the manner in which it's disseminated to the public, which is the right rule. You shouldn't have special rules. However, we're now having that same debate that we had in the late 70s. Again, it really came up in the context of these state laws, both in states like Texas and Florida, where the Republican Party is quite strong, as well as states like New York and California, where the Democratic Party is quite strong, where the laws are attempting to regulate directly how the social media platforms moderate content. And part of the concern is, some think that the platforms aren't moderating enough, that they're allowing, things like hateful content and the like to proliferate, whereas others think the platforms are moderating too much, right? And that they're censoring disfavored speech. That debate, it's not immediately intuitive, but the protections for those social media platforms rest on cases that originated, specifically with like analog news, right? There's a case from 1974, right after Watergate, where Florida had a law that said that if a newspaper editorialized against, let's say, a political candidate, that political candidate could demand the right to print a response in the newspaper, called a right of reply. Famously, President Nixon, before he resigned, was a vocal supporter of that. Of that, that a vocal supporter of a federal right to reply statute. And the Supreme Court unanimously in an opinion that when you read it, it has like two parts. The first part, you think Florida is going to win, because it's going through all of the problems with media consolidation, market concentration, and the like. And then the court said, even if that's the case, allowing a state to force a newspaper to print something in its pages is just completely anathema to the First Amendment. And it's a really, really crucial protection for the American press because it means that the government can't interfere in editorial decisions in a way where it puts the thumb on political discourse in the government's favor. And so that case and similar cases that raise similar issues are really at play in those debates. And so the Supreme Court a couple of years ago in a case called Net Choice v. Moody, effectively said, look, if there's one thing the government can't do under the First Amendment is regulate perceived bias. But we're still having these debates.
I think we've been alluding to this a little bit, especially during our immigration discussion. But my question is, like, what's new with the second Trump administration? I mean, like, how has your work changed? If I'm not mistaken, like, you testified about this to the House Judiciary Committee recently. So I'd love to get sort of a run through of those main points, possibly.
Absolutely. I mean, so we've talked about a bunch of them already.
Yeah.
The first Trump administration, we certainly saw challenges. For instance, we talked about the use of a search warrant to seize the electronic devices of a reporter in a national security leak case. During the first Trump administration, at the tail end, the Justice Department authorized the use of investigative tools short of a warrant, subpoenas and court orders to get telephone and email records from telephone and email providers of journalists. And that was a big it was a big controversy. It led the Justice Department under President Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland to issue a pretty historic reform of a policy at the Justice Department that governs when Justice Department attorneys can do that, which was re rescinded under the second Trump administration. So we saw things like that. There are variations, I think, on the same theme of things that we saw during the first Trump administration, but they're stepped up a bit. I think the Washington Post raid is probably the most clear example of an escalation because it really this hasn't happened before. So it's very rare that journalists' homes are searched. It's very rare that newsrooms are searched, and it has never happened that a reporter's home was searched in the context of an Espionage Act media leak investigation. And so that's pretty stark. But then there's also all of the issues around the Department of Homeland Security and immigration that we talked about. The concern that immigration that federal officers with agencies that are housed under the Department of Homeland Security may not be comprehensively trained on how to deal with journalists in the field, all of the FCC issues. And then you've also seen access issues. Specifically, there's two cases that are working their way through the federal courts. One involves the Associated Press, where the White House started to exclude Associated Press journalists from what's called the press pool, which is a group of news organizations that cover events where not everybody can kind of fit in the room, Oval Office sit downs and the like, and then provide that information to their members or to other news organizations. And the White House was doing so explicitly because the Associated Press made the decision to continue using Gulf of Mexico in most of its coverage while acknowledging the president's decision to change the name to Gulf of America in the United States and in U.S. territorial waters. The AP's explanation for that was it's an international news organization. Many of its readers are outside of the United States. That body of water has been known as the Gulf of Mexico for hundreds of years. It would be confusing to change the name in all of its coverage. But the White House said, until you change the name, we're going to start excluding you from the pool. And so there's some complications in terms of what happened. The AP brought the lawsuit, and the White House then changed the pool the way that the pool works. Typically, the pool was chosen by the White House Correspondents Association, in other words, chosen by a non-governmental industry body. But the White House took over who's in the pool, and a few other decisions, which kind of scrambled the whole thing procedurally. But the AP, they filed suit, they won in the district court. And part of the reason why they won, and this is what's really important, is I talked a bit about content-based regulations. So, you could think about content-based regulation as, let's say you've got a public park and the city says no discussion of war whatsoever in the public park. That would be a content-based regulation. You're only targeting speech about war. However, there's also a subspecies of content-based regulation, which is even worse, which is only pro-war or only anti-war speech in that public park. And that's referred to by the lawyers as what's called viewpoint-based discrimination, discriminating against a viewpoint. And it is almost never allowed. The courts have called it poison to a free society. And the reason is pretty basic, right? That if the government can use its authority to suppress a particular viewpoint, then it can put its thumb on the scale of public discourse in its own favor. And if you're talking about a democratic society where you really want the public to be able to freely hash out the points of debate, among the polity, you can't have the government getting involved in that debate. And so the district court found that this was clearly viewpoint discriminatory, and issued an injunction for the Associated Press. The appellate court has stayed that injunction, but we're waiting on a decision on the merits. But the bottom line is, bear in mind that viewpoint discrimination piece of it, right? Because that's the other thing that we've seen a fair amount of during the second Trump administration. And this is really clear with the chair of the Federal Communications Commission and his willingness to deploy policies and rules against news coverage that he sees as biased or unfair. So this kind of explicitly pointing to the viewpoint of the person or organization that you're targeting, it's an escalation. You usually don't see that. Even when the government's doing it, they don't say it. And then the other case that's raised interesting access issues that are particularly relevant now with what's happening in the Middle East, is the Pentagon placing restrictions on who can get credentials to enter the building. And this is the Pentagon for it was constructed in the middle of World War II, and for virtually all of its history, it's had certain areas. Obviously there are areas that are very restricted, where access is very restricted, and journalists have never been able to go because you're talking about classified information and the like. But for the areas where you've got coffee carts and like that, journalists have always been able to be in that area freely. They don't need an escort. And it also is really important to certain types of journalism. So for secretaries of defense or secretaries of war under both administrations of both parties, those cabinet officials have been pretty voluble with the press. Famously General Mattis, who was the Secretary of Defense during the first Trump administration, would go and pick his laundry up, and you'd have reporters who could follow him as he's carrying his laundry back to his office and ask him questions about the story of the day. Under Secretary of War Hegseth, that's changed. And so in the fall of 2025, the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, issued a new policy that reporters had to agree to in order to get the credential that got you access to the building. And the policy, typically it used to be, don't take photographs in this place. Make sure that if you lose your pass, you report it. Like these very basic common sense security things that you would agree to get your pass. The Pentagon built out the policy to like 20 pages, and they pointed to the solicitation of information from Pentagon personnel that hasn't been approved by the Pentagon for release as a possible reason for the denial, non-renewal, or suspension of one's press pass. Solicitation of information from Pentagon personnel might sound somewhat nefarious, but really what you're talking about is asking questions that the Pentagon doesn't like. And for that reason, virtually the entire Pentagon press corps, many of whom had worked there for decades, packed up and left the building en masse rather than agree to these new restrictions on their ability to report. And and that's something that we didn't see as much of during the first Trump administration. In that case, the New York Times has challenged the new credentialing policy on First Amendment and other grounds, and in that case is also working its way through. And in fact, actually, on the day we're recording, there's going to be the first big hearing in that case in front of the district court judge here in D.C.
Well, just to wrap things up, I mean, for listeners who are interested in continuing to kind of monitor press freedom issues in the States, what should we keep an eye on or look out for in the coming weeks or months?
Well, so first of all, go to our website, rcfp.org. We have multiple newsletters and other updates that you can sign up for. And so I encourage you to do so. My piece of the organization has a monthly newsletter. We call it the Nuance that we put out pretty regularly, where we try and find a topic that not a lot of folks have been covering, but that we think is pretty important for press freedom. And we'll write about that and highlight it, as well as highlighting, developments that you may not have seen in other cases. And so I would urge you to sign up for that. And then there's also all of the good journalists who cover kind of civil liberties issues are great to keep tabs on. The specialty publications like the Columbia Journalism Review, really great resource. And then feel free to reach out to me if I can ever be of help.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk today and for your insight.
Thanks so much. Really great to be here.